Hello, my name is Tom Crofts, and over this series of three programmes, I'm going to be exploring the relevance of Buddhism in Britain today and asking, what do the Buddha's teachings of nearly 2,600 years ago have to say to us today in the highly complex, digitised, increasingly urban and globalised society we live in? And can Buddhism help us address some of the unique personal and social challenges of the age we face, from anxiety and depression through to youth gangs, drugs and sexual abuse? In answering these questions, I will be talking to a number of practicing Buddhists and hearing from them how they have found meaning in the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. Although very few people in Britain formally identify themselves as practicing Buddhists, many people read Buddhist literature, appreciate Buddhist art, and practice Buddhist meditations. For many, their first contact with Buddhism is through a search for peace and calm in meditation. For others, it is motivated by a sense of emptiness and a search for meaning in their lives. And for a third group, it is a direct experience of the Buddha's first noble truth, the truth that life at the unenlightened level is innately unsatisfactory or even painful. That sends them in search of something higher, to help them resolve what can seem like insurmountable problems. Common to all of these reasons for coming to Buddhism is a sense of needing to connect with what is of real value in life. As F. Scott Fitzgerald said of his own times, ours is a generation which has grown up to find all gods dead, all wars fought, all faiths in man shaken. Today, we have sought to alleviate the pain associated with the loss of real value by consoling ourselves with retail therapy, state-of-the-art entertainments, and a culture of workaholism. But these tend only to detract from satisfying a much deeper longing to engage with the innate mystery of creation, and from grappling with the great questions of life. Who am I? What is my purpose in life? What happens to me when I die? It is perhaps not surprising that the question of value is front and centre in the Buddha's teaching. Buddhists traditionally go for refuge to the three jewels, the Buddha himself, the Dharma he taught, and the community of enlightened disciples and followers. For Buddhist practitioners, this is not so much a question of fleeing from our problems, as investing our energy into what is really of value, meaning, importance and consequence in life, into seeing things as they really are, in engaging with the two great values of wisdom and compassion. Unfortunately, for many of us, there is often an unconscious tension between the way we live our lives and our deeper sense of purpose and direction. We all know what it is like to have a sense of belonging or participation in something higher, whether it be supporting your local football team in the stadium, or sweeping away an unpopular government from power, or bringing a child into the world. This sense of participating in something higher was, of course, the domain of religion and the church until the 21st century. But today, although 71% of people in Britain identify themselves as Christian, less than 2% of the population regularly attends church. We are much more likely to go shopping on a Sunday than attend a service of worship. And if new government policy comes to fruition, people in Britain will be twice as likely to see a therapist on the NHS than to see a priest in church. Into this spiritual vacuum has spread a pervading culture of individualism, materialism, consumerism, and mass entertainment. We live in a society where people feel increasingly socially and politically disenfranchised by the rise of vast multinational corporations and the leadership of untrustworthy politicians. Combined with the disintegration of the family and the institution of marriage, growing levels of living alone and doing long hours in stressful jobs, this can and does have consequences at the personal level. Given these conditions, the prevalence of mental health disorders such as depression, anxiety, phobias, eating disorders and binge drinking and alcoholism is perhaps not surprising. In 2007, the Department for Health estimated that some 7 million adults in England suffer from a common mental health problem. And amidst a period of stringent government cutbacks, in January 2011, the government announced it was allocating £300 million for funding talking therapies. The reasons for increasing government support in this area are, of course, economic. Poor mental health leads to rising unemployment. According to government health figures, over 40% of people who are on incapacity benefit suffer from some form of mental rather than physical problem. But the shift away from medication towards talking therapies is significant, and perhaps an admission that merely sedating the problem doesn't make it go away. Or, to put it another way, mental states matter. and mental states were something that deeply concerned the Buddha in his search for enlightenment. But might we be going too far in drawing a connection between the social, economic, cultural, political, and spiritual conditions we live in and our individual mental states? After all, we enjoy unprecedented levels of freedom, health, and longevity in Britain today. Qualified psychotherapist accredited to the Psychosynthesis and Education Trust, Frances Marling.
It's the egotism, I suppose, of the West and the dissatisfactions that this has produced, which is so completely alienating and makes us dissatisfied and takes us towards consumerism and our addictions. It's a well-researched point that nobody is actually any happier if they suddenly get a lot of money, and collectors just become completely obsessed when once they have one thing, they want another thing. And so it's always a searching for the thing out there that's going to make us feel full or complete or more whole. And really what makes us feel full and complete and whole is connection with ourselves and with others. I mean, that is really the heart of things, to be connected with the truth of our own experience. Certainly in psychotherapy, when you actually scratch the surface and you get down to what people most long for, it's to go to sleep at night with a sense of peace and to lead a more innerly spacious life. I mean, people will very often come into therapy and they'll say, I'm so stressed and don't have any space for myself, without realising that the space is entirely within their own mind, and that there are certain practices or certain ways of looking at life which are very akin to Buddhism, which a transpersonal psychotherapy would introduce someone to, which will allow them to be so much more spacious because they're being accepting of their own truth. And when we don't accept our own truth, we suffer from conflict and anxiety and depression and lack of control over life, which is, I suppose, the main reason for depression.
So if the quality of our mental states and a sense of connection to what is most deeply of value to us are important for our mental health, then what message does Buddhism have for how we can become happier, healthier people? The Dhammapada, a book of profound sayings attributed to the Buddha, opens with a reflection on the importance of mindfulness. In it, the Buddha says, "Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox." To explore this further, I asked Punyamati, an ordained Buddhist practicing in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community and trained psychosynthesis counsellor, what relevance mindfulness had to our mental states.
With mindfulness, one has a much better framework, a much better context, you could say, for actually stepping back and looking at one's own states of mind. We can actually be with the experience, but step back and look at it rather than being completely bound up with it. And this is already very liberating and very profound. Once you really have mindfulness and you really start to observe your own mental states, your states of mind tend to improve. Mindfulness gives us the capability to distinguish what states of mind we actually want to go with and what we don't want to go with. So we can look at our states of mind, our different mental tendencies, and make a helpful, informed decision as to what to cultivate and what to just be aware of empathically, but not to indulge.
Now, you are an advocate for mindfulness-based cognitive approaches to treating mental health disorders. So what value does mindfulness have in treating problems like depression and anxiety?
We tend to be hooked by all sorts of belief systems. Some of them are conscious, some of them are less conscious. But with improved mindfulness, you can actually observe your thought processes and you don't have to believe in a thought as an absolute reality. You have a greater capacity for disidentification.
So what then do you see as the connection between values and mental states?
There was one psychologist, I think it was Viktor Frankl, who said that when people find and live from their real values, a lot of psychological problems just fall away by themselves. You could also say perhaps this is almost the same thing, that people are much more genuinely happy when they connect with and live from their deeper values. You also find that things don't get you down as much if you're still living from meaning. And if you look in history, you can see a lot of figures, a lot of people who had terrible things to endure, but because they had a really meaningful mission, somehow they could get through those things.
And what does the Buddha have to say about how we align ourselves and orient ourselves towards a greater sense of value?
The way things really are is that things are, in the mundane world, are impermanent, insubstantial, and unsatisfactory. So to really work on seeing the true nature of mundane existence, that takes us towards spiritual liberation and also practicing compassion.
Now, the Buddha was teaching 2,600 years ago. So what relevance does the Buddha's message have for us with our uniquely modern psychological challenges?
When you look at things like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, where they've taken ancient Buddhist mindfulness practice, you find that it does actually work. So I think that the level that the Buddha's teaching applies to and works on actually is not so fundamentally different now.
Well, that view comes from an ordained Buddhist with 20 years meditation experience. But I wanted to get a sense of whether these practices of mindfulness and meditation could work for ordinary practitioners with families and busy full-time jobs. For a view, I went to the Croydon Buddhist Centre to their Saturday morning drop-in class. After the class, I caught up with Ian and Malcolm, and I started by asking Ian how the practice of Buddhism had changed his life, in particular his mental states.
I think I've definitely become a lot calmer as a person, less aggressive. I think I've also become better able to understand other people's perspectives. One good example is just trying to see our relationship with other people, trying to see that what we do directly affects other people, what they do directly affects us. And I think as well, one of the true gifts of meditation actually makes you a lot more able to understand yourself. So as well as your ability to empathise and be with others, you're also able to be more aware of where you are as a person. And Buddhism teaches us some very fundamental skills of how to be human. What we need to do is to become more genuine, to become more who we truly are. For example, taking consumerism, becoming more aware of our mental states by actually having a gap between our initial impulse and our initial response. If we can learn just to put a moment of reflection or a moment of interrogation into that gap, that can really change this drive which we're seeing now towards a materialistic or consumerist society. So these are some very basic Buddhist teachings which help us to live life a bit more skillfully.
Now, Malcolm, your encounter with Buddhism was a little more dramatic. How do you think that Buddhism has affected the way that you think?
I had a breakdown, and that's when I met an older member who suggested I should meditate. I came very insular in my thinking. Everything was all around me. It's sort of, I became the centre of the universe. And I think what practicing has done for me is has opened up that I'm not the centre of the universe, and it's putting myself in a context. During the depressive episode, the breakdown period, it was why me, brought about by loss of things. And I think through the study of Buddhism as well as practice of meditation, it's not just me. This is just the way it is. And it's my approach to that, my reaction to it, which causes me suffering. So by altering that through the study, through the practice, and opening out my awareness, that boosted my self-esteem. And I can see that by being in a certain way it causes myself suffering, and will cause suffering towards others. Which is a painful place to be in. So it's that opening up, it's sort of a flowering somehow that the practice has brought about. The growth for me has been amazing, from the point of depression, from the point of very low self-esteem. That's completely turned around.
What has really come across to me in the course of these testimonies and interviews is the importance of paying attention to our minds and caring about the quality of our mental states. It's as if we just expect the mind to work straight out of the box without doing any work on it. While our education system prepares us for the calculations and plans we will one day have to make in offices and boardrooms, it doesn't prepare us well for the much bigger and more difficult existential problems that we face. Problems like finding meaning and purpose in our lives and experiencing peace and contentment. It is as if we are so busy getting on with the process of making our way in the world that we have lost touch with ourselves and the world we live in. And so our relationships break down and our environment is degraded. Of course, nobody actually sets out to be alienated from what is of deeper importance to them. We simply get lost. And this is where Buddhist teachings offer a better way of doing things. Through the practice of mindfulness, we can enjoy greater levels of empathy, choice, and clarity, and we can become masters of our own destiny, rather than being enslaved to our conditioning. With this goes a sense of peace and space, an inner contentment and greater self-awareness that leads to a richer experience of life. It can even assist in overcoming serious mental health problems. In short, cultivating the mind leads to happiness. As the Buddha says, "I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when undeveloped and uncultivated, entails such great suffering as the mind. The mind, when undeveloped and uncultivated, entails great suffering. I do not perceive even one other thing, O monks, that when developed and cultivated, entails such great happiness as the mind. The mind, when developed and cultivated, entails great happiness." One of the Buddha's great contributions to human thought is his great insight into the nature of the mind, which makes Buddhism such a uniquely psychological religion. One of the Buddha's most fundamental teachings is that all things are conditioned. This seemingly obvious statement has very profound implications, as the Buddha reveals the clear causal chain of links within the mind that lead to unhappiness. It is also a message of great hope. If everything we experience is conditioned, then by altering the conditions, we can alter our experience. So what do we have to do in order to cultivate the mind and set up the conditions for happiness? In the initial stages at least, the mind needs to be calmed and steadied to begin to see the wider patterns that govern our lives. This process starts very simply by the practice of being present to our actual experience, rather than being continually distracted. Back to Francis Marling.
We're so controlled by our past experiences, which we invariably imagine and dread as being our future experiences, that living in the present moment is very alien to us in the West. And I think that mindfulness is probably the most powerful tool for bringing oneself into what is actually truly happening now, and that nothing is as good nor bad as our thinking makes it so.
As we begin to bring our attention to what is happening right now, we become much more sensitive. In particular, we begin to see the effects that our actions, speech, and thought have on ourselves and the people around us. And as we begin to bring attention to the consequences of our actions, it becomes much harder actively to choose to be unethical. In a sense, we can only really be unethical by cutting off from appreciating how other people feel when we act in a certain way. We also see that we have an underlying tendency to avoid unpleasant feelings by gratifying our senses. We have a bad day, so we indulge in chocolate or go to the pub or watch television to forget all about it. But this only works until the next time we're feeling bad. And as the Buddha tells us, there will always be a next time so long as we live in an unenlightened state. For all of Buddhism's image in popular culture as a liberal philosophy, the message here is quite uncompromising. As the Buddha says, "There comes a time, monks, when the great ocean dries up and evaporates and no longer exists. But still, I say, there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Even if nothing else intervenes, we will eventually succumb to the sufferings of old age, sickness, and death." In the face of this reality, the Buddha exhorts us to be mindful and kind, wise and compassionate. In this programme, we have mainly been concerned with the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness. But in the next of this series of three podcasts, I will be exploring the Buddha's teaching on compassion, with a focus on the relevance of the Buddha's teachings for some of the collective and social challenges that we currently face.